We're continuing with our theme of symbols and stories. And as Vajratara said last week, we've sort of run out of structure. So we're now just talking about stories that we like. So I put myself down this evening for talking about Shariputra and the flowers, and I've changed my mind. I'm going to talk about Milarepa instead, because I think it's more what we need to hear or what we need to think about. It's a great story. The story of Milarepa is a terrific story, which really every Buddhist should know. And it also illustrates some really important points about the Dharma. So that's what we're going to look at. It particularly illustrates the need for commitment to a spiritual path, and the fact that the spiritual path will bring us up against ourselves. It won't always be easy. It won't always be pleasant. And we need to be prepared for that. So we'll see a bit more about those themes when we get to them and how they relate to us. Maybe when we've just talked a little bit more and explored Milarepa and his life. So Milarepa actually means something like Miller who dresses in cotton. And that name was actually given to him later in his life, in recognition of the fact that he was a meditator in the high mountains of Tibet, who generally wore only a cotton robe, a thin cotton robe, if that, even in the winter. So Milarepa, who dresses in cotton. But he was actually originally called something like Milatopaga, which means something like he who is a joy to listen to. Which is maybe a bit of a prophetic name, because Milarepa, the person who became known as Milarepa, also became one of Tibet's most famous poets, and maybe the Buddhist world, one of the Buddhist world's most famous poets. And his songs, which are often really joyful, so maybe he is a joy to listen to. And his songs are still very popular today. I'm sure we've got a copy of them in the library and in the bookshop. But everyone calls him Milarepa, so I'm going to call him Milarepa, even before he had the name Milarepa, just because that's less confusing that way. So Milarepa was born into a prosperous landowning family in the village of something like Kyanagatsa, something like that, in Tibet, not far from the border with Nepal. And he was born sometime around 1050 of the Christian era. So, 15 years before England was invaded by the Normans, while our ancestors were still speaking Anglo-Saxon and things like that. And he was born into a prosperous family, as I said. But when Milarepa was just seven, he was just 7 years old, still a little boy, tragedy struck his family, as I suppose tragedy strikes every family at some time. So when Milarepa was still just a boy, just 7 years old, his father fell ill and began wasting away before the family's eyes. And the family, they got money, they called in the best doctors they could find, and as people do in traditional societies, they called in the best magicians they could find. But apparently to no avail, apparently nothing seemed to make any difference. So Milarepa's father was obviously dying. He was obviously on a downhill path. And of course he was really worried about his wife and his children, and how they'd get by without him. So he asked his sister and her husband to come and pay him a visit. And they came to talk to him, and he made a very serious request. He said, "Look, I'm dying. My children are still young. I don't think my wife can look after the estate and the farm and manage the children. Please look after my estate for me. You can have a share in its wealth, but in return I want you to make a really solemn promise. I want you to make a solemn promise. I want you to promise that you will look after my wife, respect her, that you will look after my children as though they were your own, and that when my son comes of age, when my son, or eldest son comes of age, you'll help him gradually assume control of the farm and the estate as he matures." And of course the aunt and the uncle were delighted. So the aunt and the uncle were delighted about this, and they solemnly promised, oh yes, of course we'll respect and look after your family. We'll look after your children as though they were our own. But as they promised this, part of their minds was rubbing their hands in glee at getting their hands on the estate, and the farm and the house. And maybe looking after Milarepa and his mother and the rest of the family was looming less large in their mind. But of course, while Milarepa's father was struggling on his struggling to sort of with his last days, they kept up the pretense. But then, as soon as the father died, and as soon as the lengthy funeral ceremonies had taken place, they started to show their true colours. So they moved into the big house, and they treated it as their own. They took all the income from the farm and the estate, and used that as though Milarepa's mother didn't exist, didn't have any say in it. And far from respecting and looking after the family, they bossed Milarepa's family around, spoke harshly to them, even offered violence to them if they didn't do as they were told. They forced them to work as servants, or even maybe as slaves. And this went on for years, and there seemed to be nothing that Milarepa's mother could do about it. She was just completely overpowered. So she appealed to the villagers in the nearby village for help. But Milarepa's uncle was now the big man in the village. He was the big man in the village now, and the villagers weren't going to sort of cross him and get on the wrong side of him for the sake of a powerless, penniless, landless woman. So no help came from the villagers. They didn't attempt to sort of see that justice was done. And the virtual slavery of Milarepa and his family carried on for years and years. And as this situation went on, Milarepa's mother became more and more bitter, more and more resentful, and more filled with hate. Her face became ugly and twisted, and she sort of chewed on her ill will towards Milarepa's uncle and aunt, and towards the villagers, who had refused to make sure that justice was done, had been willing to let this terrible injustice happen. And she started to brood on plans for revenge. And unfortunately for Milarepa, or maybe fortunately as things turned out, these plans centred on her son. Young Milarepa. She decided the only way she'd get enough power to wreak vengeance on the evil couple who had ruined her life and stolen everything she had, was to get the young Mila trained up as a black magician. So Mila's mother dug up the small hoard of coins that she'd managed to sort of hide from the evil aunt and uncle. And she gave them to Mila, to Milarepa, to use as a payment for his training in black magic. And she packed him off to a well-known black magician who lived several days' walk away. So Mila left the valley, left his home, very sad at doing so, but following his mother's wishes, and he made his way to find this magician. He gave him his fee, and he was accepted as an apprentice on the basis of this fee. And apparently he proved a really gifted apprentice. He soon mastered the general principles of black magic. He could focus his emotions and his awareness to the point where he could cast spells and influence what happened in the world around him. He could meditate with such concentration that he could contact beings and energies that you don't really want to contact, if you've got any sense. So he was a very, very gifted pupil. And when he'd shown himself to be such a gifted pupil, he revealed to his master, the black magician, the real reason his mother had paid for his apprenticeship. And he asked for an initiation that would give him the power to wreak vengeance on his uncle and his aunt and the villagers who'd refused to help them. And the master, the black magician, said, "Yes, you're a good student. You've paid me well. I think I've got just the initiation for you. This is a really powerful practice. I'm going to give you the initiation and practice of Jah with the purple black face, along with his death-causing mantra. This is a really powerful and high initiation and practice. And it's just right for your purpose. So the magician gave Milarepa the initiation, he taught him the practice and the mantra, and he sent him off to meditate on it. So Milarepa retired to meditate in his solitary cell, and he meditated for day after day after day. And after days and days of meditating in his dark cell, one black night, he was suddenly no longer just visualizing the ugly countenance of Jah with the purple black face, but the ugly, awesome, wrathful form of Jah with the purple black face was actually there in the space in front of him, in all his sort of huge and horrible reality. And this awesome voice boomed out, You've been calling on me for days. Are you sure this is really what you want? Because I'll give you what you're asking for. I will be your protector deity. I'll stand behind you and give you my power as you wreak vengeance on your enemies. If you're sure. But beware what you ask, because I'll give it to you, and it might be more than you bargained for. But Milarepa, dutiful to his mother, replied, I'm sure, I want your help in my vengeance. And then suddenly a whole mandala of horrific deities appeared to Milarepa, and they were juggling with 35 severed heads and 35 bleeding severed hearts. So Milarepa had got what he asked for. He got what his mother sent him away to get. He had a powerful initiation, a powerful protector deity, and a powerful death-dealing mantra. He now had the power. He had the power to wreak his mother's revenge for her, to act out her hate and bitterness. So he made his farewells to the black magician, who'd given him what he paid for, and he made his way back towards his old home. And when he got there, he contacted his mother in secret, and she told him that his aunt and uncle would soon be celebrating the marriage of their son. And they'd be having a party in their house to celebrate this marriage, a feast, and that many of the villagers, many of the foremost villagers would be invited to this party. In what used to be their old house, and that this would be the perfect opportunity to wreak vengeance when they're all gathered together. So Milarepa went out to a cave in the hills nearby, and he meditated on his deity. He chanted his death-dealing mantra. He concentrated his mind and his emotions and his power, rehearsing in his mind what he was going to do to destroy his uncle's house in the party, when the party was in progress. And then the day came, and he put the spell into practice. He summoned his protector, he concentrated his power, he chanted his deadly mantra, and while the party was in full swing, he filled the house with terrible, horrible, creeping things. Scorpions and spiders and centipedes and all sorts of horrible, creepy crawlies. And these terrified the guests. They were terrified the guests, so they were all panicking and stampeding about. And more to the point, they terrified all the guests' horses who were in the stables, which was actually part of the house. And the horses panicked, and they broke free, and they stampeded around, and they kicked at the walls, and they kicked at the pillars that were supporting the roof, until the house started to literally shake. And Milarepa also conjured up one particularly huge scorpion, bigger than a horse, which went around stabbing the supports of the house and the supports of the roof with its terrifically huge tail. And amidst the panic, of course, the horses stampeding around, kicking the supports of the house, the scorpion jabbing the supports of the house. The inevitable happened. The house began to collapse, crushing and burying all the guests who hadn't been killed in other ways by the horses or died of fright from the creepy crawlies. Until all there was left was a heap of timbers and 35 bleeding bodies. And the only people who survived were Milarepa's uncle and aunt, who, with characteristic instinct for self-preservation, had got out before the house fell down. But Milarepa's mother, she'd had her revenge. She'd had her revenge on the uncle and aunt by killing their son and his bride on their wedding day. She'd had her revenge on the villagers by causing the death of quite a lot of them. But that wasn't enough for her. She egged Mila on at that point. She egged Mila on to summon up a great hailstorm as well, which destroyed all the villagers' crops. And so left the villagers without food for the coming year. And of course the villagers and the aunt and the uncle were just, well, they were absolutely furious. They turned on Milarepa and his mother and the family and chased them out of the village. They had to flee for their lives and just make their way away. So Milarepa's mother got what she wanted. She got revenge. And Milarepa got what he wanted. He had great power now as a black magician. If he wanted, he could do almost anything. He could charge any price for his magical powers. He was a black magician. But after the event, actually, Milarepa was just left terribly, terribly troubled. He'd courted evil. He'd flirted with evil. He'd done more than that. He'd really cohabited with evil and he'd done evil. He concentrated his mind on evil intentions and killed 35 people, not to mention those that might have died of starvation afterwards. He knew he was in deep spiritual trouble. He knew he was sullied, he was polluted. The stream of his being was polluted and he'd done it. He knew that he'd strengthened some awful strands in his being, which would cause him terrible suffering in the future. Whatever the worldly power or success he had, there was no way he was going to hide from it. There was no way to hide. This was going to cause him to manifest in a terrible realm in his next rebirth. He knew he'd acquired absolutely awful karma in the traditional sense. And that, put in the sort of simple terms of the village he came from, meant that he was destined for a very, very nasty hell. That's how he would have thought of it. And he was terrified. He was quite rightly terrified, actually. He was so terrified that he was desperate for a way out. He was desperate to clear away the terrible karma he'd created. He was desperate, and he was terrified and desperate to follow the spiritual life. Because he knew that was the only way he was going to escape from what he'd created. And he was terrified, and rightly so. Because fear is a perfectly valid motivation for following the spiritual path. There are states of being we don't want to experience, we don't want to live in. There are spiritual places we don't want to go. And Milarepa was looking down both barrels of a very nasty rebirth, at the best. And he knew the only way to escape was to find a spiritual teacher, follow a positive spiritual path that would counteract the negative spiritual path, the intensely negative spiritual path that he'd followed so far, ever since he met with a black magician. So Milarepa searched and he searched and he searched for a teacher, wandering about, asking everybody if they could point him in the right direction. And eventually he was directed to the farm of his future guru, his future teacher, Marpa. Marpa the translator, as he's often called. So Marpa was a farmer and a landowner and a family man, and maybe not at all most people's idea of a spiritual teacher. He was built on a sort of chunky scale. And he could be fierce. He could be a bit irritable. He could be positively angry. But he was the real thing. Marpa was the real thing. He had made the arduous trip to India at least two times to learn the teachings from Naropa. He'd swallowed his ego and his pride, despite being a prosperous man, and sat at Naropa's feet, this homeless wanderer, as his apprentice, saying, "I don't know, you teach me." He'd stuck it even when Naropa refused to give him advanced teachings, because these weren't right for him, because he needed to get beyond his worldly egotism before he could benefit from them. He'd done it the hard way. He had real spiritual experience. He'd really put energy and effort into it, including going to India. He knew how to practice himself. And he knew how Milarepa needed to practice. He knew that straight away. He knew how Milarepa needed to practice to overcome his terrible karma. So, with Marpa, Milarepa did not get what he wanted as a spiritual teacher, but he got what he needed. He wanted some advanced meditation practices that would speed him towards his goal. After all, in his eyes, he was an advanced meditator already. He could concentrate his will and do terrible damage. He was special. And his previous teacher, the black magician, had recognized his talent, recognized his quality, and quickly given him an advanced practice. So, surely Marpa would see that he was so special and would give him an advanced practice straight away. No. Marpa was a bit more sus than that. He saw that Milarepa's problem was his pride and his ego and his very sense that he was special. And his pride and his ego and the sense that he was special had been fed by his apparent success in meditation rather than being weakened by it. Milarepa needed the wisdom of humility and simplicity. He needed to stop thinking he was so special. He needed to admit that he was a mess, in fact, and humbly offer himself for teaching as a beginner. So for 6 years, Marpa refused to give Milarepa any meditation teaching whatsoever. What he did was to instruct him, to get him, to force him to forget his own desires and act as a servant. And to be honest, Marpa was pretty rough about it. Marpa had never done a course in nonviolent communication, I'm absolutely convinced. He mockingly used to call Milarepa great sorcerer. "Come, great sorcerer, wash the dishes." And he ordered him about like the lowest servant. The story goes that he instructed Milarepa to build a stone tower on a ridge above the farm. And he instructed him to carry the stones up on his back. So Milarepa, every day, carrying his heavy stones up the ridge on his back, putting them together, mortar, building the tower. And then when he just about finished and just was about to stand back and say, "Milarepa, you're pretty damn good at building towers. Not many people could have done that." Marpa stormed up the hill and said, "What do you think you're doing building a tower on this ridge? I told you to build it on that ridge. Go on, take it down. Take it down. Carry the stones back up that ridge and build it where I told you to. You've wasted weeks already, so get on with it." So once again, Milarepa carried the heavy stones up the ridge, stacked them on top of each other, fitted them together to build a tower. And we're told that his back and his hands were actually bleeding from the work. And just again, as he thought his work was done, Marpa came up the hill and said, did I really ask you to build it on this ridge? Oh, I must have been drunk. I meant it on that ridge over there. That one. Could you take it down and put it over there?" So that's how it was. That was the sort of treatment he was getting. So Marpa refused to give Milarepa the teaching he wanted. He refused even to teach him meditation. And instead he gave him the training in humility that he needed. He pretended to be extremely harsh and dismissive, calling Milarepa great sorcerer. Ha ha, great. Come on, great sorcerer. But we're told that he secretly had a very, very high regard for Milarepa. He saw that he had really got something. And he actually thought of him as his spiritual son, the best disciple he would ever have, or was ever likely to have. But Marpa's wife was very, very upset by the treatment that Marpa was dishing out to Milarepa. She felt really sorry for Milarepa, and, you know, maybe it does her credit. And one day Milarepa went and cried on her shoulder. You know, this is awful. I 6 years, he's taught me nothing. All I do is sort of carry stones up hills, muck out the yaks. I don't know, things you do in Tibet. I said, I'm in complete despair. I think I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. Marpa's never going to give me the teachings I want, and I'm not getting anywhere. So Marpa's wife, from the most sympathetic of motives, decided that her husband was being far too hard on Milarepa, who was, after all, a very talented meditator. And, I mean, I don't know, maybe Marpa was jealous, I don't know, and surely he'd be better to go to another teacher who could appreciate his special qualities and give him the teachings he wanted. So Marpa's wife forged a letter from Marpa recommending Milarepa to another teacher elsewhere. And Marpa and Milarepa ran away. He ran away from the difficult Marpa, looking for a spiritual teacher more to his taste. And indeed, his new teacher was much more to his taste. He gave him the advanced meditation practices that he wanted. And Milarepa followed his instructions to the letter, day after day, night after night. And at first that was really exciting, and I've got these wonderful practices. But then the gloss started to wear off, it became ordinary, he was doing it day after day, it became routine. And after a while, he realized they weren't really making any difference to his mental states. And he had to admit, gradually, that he wasn't getting anywhere. And his new teacher noticed this as well. And Marpa says he's ready for these practices, but it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem that they make any difference to him. So he started to ask around, and he actually contacted Marpa, and discovered that Marpa had never recommended him. The letter was a forgery. Came to his conclusion that Marpa was really Milarepa's teacher, that Milarepa had run away from what he needed, looking for a way that was more to his taste, and so of course he just wasn't going to make any progress. So Milarepa went back to Marpa with his tail between his legs. And Marpa told his wife that if she hadn't done this, if she hadn't done what she had done, Milarepa would have made wonderful progress. But seeing that what had happened, he would now start teaching Milarepa to meditate. Although he really should have waited a bit longer, and that would have been much better for him. He should have purified his karma and humbled his proud ego a bit more, and then he really would have got somewhere. But as it was, well, seeing as you took it into your hands, I'll teach him to meditate now. So Marpa did give Milarepa the teachings. He instructed him in various advanced tantric meditations, and he sent him off to meditate alone in the mountains. And Milarepa followed Marpa's instructions big time. Big time. Followed Marpa's instructions. He really followed Marpa's instructions. He lived for years in a high mountain cave, high up in the snows, with no comforts, often even with no food, with only the thinnest of clothes, hence cotton-clad Miller. Or even no clothes at all. There's a really interesting story about when his sister goes to visit him and gets really embarrassed because she can see his penis. She wants to give him some trousers. and some beer and some lamb. Anyway, so he lived in that environment, meditating with all the energy of his being, knowing that if he didn't make real spiritual progress in this lifetime, his next manifestation would not be much fun at all. In fact, it would be very unpleasant, given all the evil he'd poisoned himself with. And we're told that for a long time he lived on just nettle soup. And in fact that he ate so many nettles that he turned green. And you often see pictures of Milarepa looking green, because all the nettles he's eaten. And all the while he was meditating in this terrific poverty, in his cold mountain cave, Milarepa's heart was full of warm gratitude to his teacher, Marpa. The man who had not given him what he wanted, in a spiritual sense, but had given him what he needed. Given him what he needed to liberate himself from his ego. Milarepa became a very, very famous poet, as well as a famous meditator, and many of his poems are songs of gratitude to his teacher, Milarepa. He sings his gratitude to this man, who had been wise enough and strong enough to break him out of his old patterns of being, to help him break out of his old patterns of being, and in which he'd got trapped. So with this combination of strenuous exertion, single-minded exertion in meditation, and warm gratitude and devotion to his teacher, after 12 years of meditating in the mountains, Milarepa broke through and became completely enlightened. And in time he had his own disciples, and one of these disciples founded one of the foremost schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the Kagyu, which still exists today and in fact has a temple on the Scottish borders near Lockerbie. So Milarepa had a terrific influence, and he lived quite a life. He lived quite an amazing life. So what can we learn from it? What can we learn? What lessons can we learn from this life of Milarepa? So, well, I've got a few possibles and then a few things that we might do to actually put them into practice. So the first lesson from the life of Milarepa is that being a great meditator is not the same thing as making spiritual progress. Being a great meditator is not the same thing as being spiritually advanced. Under his first teacher, the black magician, Milarepa became a great meditator. He could concentrate his will to amazing degrees, but this only served to pour strength into his unskillful aspects. Unskillful aspects of his being. It only served to increase his pride and his ego. And he then had to spend years and years and years undoing the effect of his unskillful meditation. Had spent years and years humbling his ego in ways that had nothing whatsoever to do with meditation. So spiritual life is about reducing our obsession with ourselves, being more connected with others. In a word, it's about being less selfish and less self-centered. And there are several near enemies of the spiritual life that look a bit like the spiritual life, but actually increase our egocentricity. It can make us withdrawn into ourselves. It can make us proud of our achievements as meditators. It can make us think we're really special. It can make us obsessed with our own feelings and the workings of our own mind and our own health. So it all becomes about me, my mental states, etc., etc. And that is a near enemy of the spiritual life. It is not the spiritual life. So I don't want to give the wrong impression. I mean, it's great to meditate. We need to meditate. But ethics comes first. In fact, we need to meditate in order to be a more ethical being, not in order to be a great meditator, and not in order to be powerful, or a powerful magician, certainly. So we need to watch what we meditate on. Perhaps it's really obvious that we don't want to meditate on wrathful figures like Zart with the blue-black face. Although actually, it's easier to get an initiation into something like Da with the blue-black face than it is to get a sadhana in the Western Buddhist order. You can go out and do it. It's easy enough. Yeah? But it can have some very bad effects. But that's maybe an extreme version. We do need to watch what we meditate on. All meditation is not necessarily positive. And a related point is that getting what we want in the spiritual life isn't the same thing as getting what we need. So one example is that we often want advanced practices. But that isn't usually what we need. So there's a Tibetan teacher called Chogyam Trungpa. I never quite know how to pronounce that. Somebody can correct me. But anyway, he wrote a book. He coined the phrase spiritual materialism to describe this. Spiritual materialism includes wanting a bigger and better practice. And it's just ego. It's just more ego. It's like wanting a bigger and better car. The advanced practice won't get us anywhere if the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana aren't. If they're not working, there's no point in going for the next one. There's no point in going for a bigger one. If you can't drive a bicycle, don't buy a Harley Davidson. And a Harley Davidson won't do you much good on country tracks. Anyway, I won't take this analogy too far. So that's one point. We want advanced practices. Just ego, usually spiritual materialism. And the second point is that spiritual life needs to challenge our ego and our arrogance and our self-view. If it doesn't do this, it isn't doing its job. But of course, we don't want our ego challenged. We don't want our self-view challenged. So we resist it. And then what often happens is that we stop. We go somewhere else. We go somewhere else. This is challenging me. I'll go somewhere else. So, I mean, Marpa challenged Milarepa's ego, and that wasn't what he wanted. So he went somewhere else. He went off to another teacher. And that's often what we do. When a spiritual life starts to bite, our ego gets uncomfortable. So we look for an easier way that's more in accord with our likes and dislikes. So I believe it's a Sufi story which illustrates this. There's a Sufi story which says, if you want to get to water under the ground, actually there's water under quite a lot of the ground, but you need to dig in one place. You dig in a hole in one place, and that's the way to get to the water, not to dig lots of shallow holes all over the place. Yeah? But if you start digging in one place, you'll probably hit a layer of rock before you hit the water. And at that point, the temptation is to say, well, this isn't a very good hole. It's got rock in it. I'll try somewhere else. But then you can go and try somewhere else, and you will hit rock there too. And people will keep trying the spiritual life until they hit rock, and then try another one, and another one, and another one. And what you get is a lot of shallow holes. A lot of shallow holes, and we stay shallow. So we need commitment in the spiritual life. And Milarepa is a bit of an object lesson in commitment, although he sort of slid away a bit. But he's an object lesson in commitment. He succeeded. He succeeded precisely where most people fail, because he had enough commitment to carry him through the hard times, to carry him through building the towers and so on for 6 years, to carry him through 12 years of meditation in a mountain cave, until he eating nettles till he turned green, and he apparently developed calluses on his rear end. But commitment is really unfashionable at the moment, and that is terrible news for human beings and their happiness, because without commitment we stay shallow. We flit around, ruled by our trivial likes and dislikes, with no consistent direction. So we often may think that lack of commitment equals freedom, but it's the exact opposite. Freedom is only freedom, it's only got any reality, if it's freedom to decide what our life is about. Freedom is only freedom if it's freedom to decide what our life is about. And if we never make that decision and commit to it, then we haven't used our freedom. We might as well not have it. And we'll live lives of indecision and anxiety and triviality, wondering what we should be doing. So I think in a way that's the big teaching of Milarepa. It's the need for commitment in the spiritual life if we really want to get somewhere. So I've sort of got a few checklist of points that we could take away from this, almost like a one, two, three steps for the spiritual life. The first is decide on a spiritual path. That seems pretty obvious. Decide on a spiritual path. Think about it, yeah. Don't rush into it foolishly. Make sure that it's, you know, you think it's a genuine spiritual path. Look at what it does to people. Look at how people come out of it. Make sure it's not a con. Make sure it makes some degree of sense. But don't sit on the fence forever. Spending years and years and years thinking about deciding which spiritual path to follow is like spending ages and ages deciding what to have for dinner. You just stay hungry. At some point you have to decide what to cook. So we need first of all to decide on a spiritual path. Not being daft, but we need to make a decision. We don't have forever. Life is short. So decide on a spiritual path and then commit to it. If you can't commit to the one we offer here, go and find another one for heaven's sakes. It'd be better to do that and do it full-heartedly than to be half-hearted about following this one. So that's the second point. Decide on a path and then commit to it. Do it wholeheartedly. And then, having chosen a spiritual path, don't expect that path to always give you what you want. Milarepa didn't get what he wanted from Marpa, he got what he needed. You're really lucky if you get what you want, what you need rather than what you want. Though you might not like it. So, I mean, a few examples about this. People, very often when people come to this centre, you know, we teach a range of practices and there's some they don't like. So very often people don't like the Metta Bhavana. A range of people don't like the Metta Bhavana. So I'm not going to do the Metta Bhavana. I don't like it. And that's very obvious to the outsider that that's people who aren't very at home with their emotions, don't like the Metta Bhavana, and are resistant to doing it. It's equally obvious that they're the very people who most need to do the Metta Bhavana. That's not what they like, but it's what they need. It's precisely what Marpa would have said. And you don't need to be a spiritual genius to see that. Then you've got other people who say, well, I don't like study as a practice. I don't see the point of study as a practice. And funnily enough, that always seems to be the people who really do need to think more clearly. They don't want to study as a practice, but it's what they need. So it might be a good idea to think, what don't I like? And maybe that's precisely what I need to do. Why don't I like it? Is it just because that's, you know, that's the sort of trends I've built up in my being? So don't expect the spiritual life to always give you what you want. Be grateful, like Milarepa was, when it gives you what you need. And then expect the going to get tough. And when it gets tough, don't blame the path, don't blame the movement, don't blame the teacher, don't blame the Dharma. It's supposed to get tough. That's the sign that it's challenging our ego and our fixed self-view and our pride and our fixed ideas. If the Dharma fits in exactly with what we want, fits in with all our opinions, then it has no power to move us towards transcending the person we are at the moment. It's just fitted in with the person we are at the moment and it won't move us on to another level of being. So that's my sort of checklist from Milarepa. Choose a teaching, choose a path. Not foolishly and not in a rush, but choose one. Don't delay forever. And then commit to it. If it's not this one, commit to another one and do it as wholeheartedly as you can. Don't expect that path to always give you what you need. Maybe it's the bits of it that you're reactive to that are precise. Don't expect to give you what you want. Maybe it's the bits that you're reactive to that are precisely what you need. Expect the going to get tough and don't blame it. If you don't want it to get tough, don't start. Because growing, moving beyond who we are now, is going to always feel a little bit uncomfortable. And if the Dharma fits in with who we are now completely and our opinions, then, well, it's not going to do anything. We might as well invent our own Dharma and just have that one. So those are sort of some points I would take from the story of Milarepa. And lastly, I suppose, something that he illustrates is that the choice can be pretty stark, actually. I mean, for Milarepa, he could see absolutely clearly that one way lay suffering and the other way lay progress and happiness, spiritual progress. This was really obvious to Milarepa because he'd had such an appalling start. But it's often less obvious to us who sort of live more, less extreme lives somehow. We're sort of okay. And we don't have the same sort of push. But it's often it's often the fact that the people who see most clearly that there's a choice between suffering and spiritual progress are precisely those people who have been in spiritual trouble, or are in spiritual trouble, and who go for it. They might have gone for being, they might have really gone for it when they were actually acting very unskillfully. And it's better, you know, than to go for it when we're acting skillfully, rather than to sort of have a tepid approach to everything. So a reasonable, yeah, it's often the people who go for it, because they actually see that choice very starkly, who really make quick spiritual progress, where, like Milarepa, whereas a sort of reasonable, prudent, English approach to the spiritual life, well, you might end up thinking, I've been doing this for a long time, but I don't seem to be getting far. So, watch it. So that's a bit about Milarepa. That's a bit about Milarepa and his life.